PFT Media.
This is The Experience with Chris Fio. In each episode, Fio brings his unique and unashamed interview style to Central Florida. He conducts honest and open interviews with people that have the vocabulary and expertise that he lacks.
Ana Vizquay Escamani is an American politician who is a member of the Florida House of Representatives from the 47th District in Orange County. I had the great honor of interviewing her at a downtown office. We talked about voting rights, bullying, and the blending of cultures.
Hustler, gun in a holster. That vision is slipping like a worn transmission. The days of transporting and not transmitting, cause the transcontinental flow got me transient. I ain't transcribed the transcript. I fell in a trance and let the translation transfix. I'm a transcendent the hood. I'm translucent.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Experience with Chris Fio. Today, I have a very special guest, and I was thinking earlier about how to properly introduce you, and then it came to me, why don't I have you introduce your title and name? So, tell us who you are, Ana.
Happy to do that. My name is Ana V. Escamani, and I am an Orlando native, daughter of immigrants, proud Orange County school grad, and the elected State House Representative for District 47 here in Central Florida.
And it's an honor to have you on the podcast today, and it's and I'm really happy that you actually scheduled us in.
Oh, of course, yeah. We love talking to our local leaders and community advocates, so it's great to be here.
Well, thank you. All right, my first question for you today is, when did you first realize your job was to be of service to people?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, actually, my first effort at bringing people together around a common issue was when I was 10 years old. And I was actually collecting petitions in my class because one of my best friends at the time was being moved to a different lunch period, and I refused not to have lunch with her. So I collected petitions with my classmates to keep her in our same lunch period.
That's really adorable.
Well, all politics is local.
Yes.
It didn't actually work out. My organizing did not lead to a successful campaign, but I never stopped, you know, bringing people together around common causes. And that was really, I think, when the bug first bit me on this notion of like bringing people together around a common issue. And even when I was 10 years old, that same time, I was really engaged with watching the presidential elections and printing out the polling every day. So I've always just been really, really inclined to care about community and to care about civics.
That's really interesting. Even at a young age, you were already, like, as they say, born 25. It's interesting that you already had that in you.
And yeah. Well, my parents were immigrants from Iran, and I think I also knew at a young age that not everyone's treated the same. I mean, my parents were poor as well compared to others. We were always struggling to make bills on time. And for a long part of my life, I shared a room with my twin sister because we didn't have enough money for more room. So it was, I think, also those lived experiences around, you know, everyday people need to exercise efficacy. And in Iran, politics are so bad and so bloody that you hold appreciation for our democracy and you don't want to take that for granted.
Right. That's interesting. I wanted to actually go more into, like, the stark differences. Like, how did, like, what is the difference between the politics over there versus here?
Oh, gosh. Well, in particular, there really is not a real democracy in Iran. I mean, it's quite authoritarian. People have died in the streets protesting for their rights. Iran has been through so many different revolutions in such a short amount of time as well. And the population is very young. Actually, two-thirds of Iran's population are young people under the age of like 35.
Really?
Yeah, because when the Islamic Revolution happened in 1979, the supreme leader of Iran wanted a population boom and really encouraged families to have children. And so to a point where in the early, late 80s, they were asked to stop. And now Iran actually has some of the best family planning policies because they realize the growth they couldn't sustain. But now you have this generation of post-revolution adults who don't have an alignment with the Islamic revolution or the government. They really, you know, look towards other countries like the United States, countries in Europe as their role models, their examples. And so you see this new growth of democracy, but again, you know, I always tell folks it's, you really can't even compare the two because we have a system of checks and balances. You know, we have elections that matter. And unfortunately in Iran, oftentimes it feels like your vote doesn't count. Oh,
wow. So do you think Americans are a little spoiled and they don't have any empathy towards that, or they don't understand?
It's a great question. I think there's a lot of misinformation. I mean, if we're talking about specifically Iran and the United States, I think there is a lot of misinformation and misconceptions about Iranians. Unfortunately, when you're watching the news, you know, all you see are really ugly images of Iran, not the everyday people of Iran. And I do think we need to share more stories. There's actually a new Iranian-American romantic comedy coming out soon.
Really?
That I just read about yesterday.
What's that called?
And I actually can't remember the name. I literally just saw it on Twitter yesterday. It's like an indie film.
Oh.
And it's actually about an interracial relationship between an Iranian-American and a white American. And it's really cool to see, you know, culture be shared on different platforms, especially through arts, because I think that is the way that we can actually change the politics on it. I have the title. I'll pull up in a second. It's celebrating different ways that love can exist. And it is called A Simple Wedding.
A Simple Wedding.
And so a new Iranian-American romantic comedy that captures really the cultural differences, but also what we have in common between our different worlds. And I'm always really excited and proud to share that with others. And I think at the end of the day, when it comes to voter engagement of Americans, across the board, we need more engagement. I mean, across the board, we need to ensure that everyday Americans understand the value of their vote. Because at this point, you know, we see voter turnout sometimes hovering around 50% to 60%. And we really need to make sure that every American knows A, how to vote, and that B, their vote actually counts.
Right. Why is it only hovering around 50%? Is that a lack of knowledge of how to vote, or just the disdain for it?
There's I think you could say both, but also a little bit more, right? I mean, there's definitely the notion that folks don't think their vote counts. And I have met voters who, we were their first election because it was the first time they were actually excited about voting for someone, someone they could relate to, someone they felt like cared about them. So I think there is this notion of individuals not feeling like their vote counts. And as elected officials, as candidates, as organizers, as folks who care about democracy, we need to do our part to make sure that no one feels like their vote doesn't count and to exercise that power. There also is the fact that people might literally miss elections, or they think they're registered to vote when they're not really, because in some other parts of the world, you're automatically registered to vote. Many young people don't update their address, and so they might be a transient person, so they've moved, and they get to their polling location, and they can't vote because they never update their address to their new county. So that's a common issue as well.
Ran into that before.
Right. Many college students do, too. When I used to do college organizing, that was very common, where students would say, I'm going to vote right now, and then they get in line, and they're at the wrong location. I would drive students to the right polling location sometimes just to make sure they could actually vote, but it was the lack of education on, like, what are those policies that actually let me vote. And then the last thing I'll say, too, is we do have voter suppression in our country and in our state. Different laws around requirements of specific IDs, intimidation tactics at the polls. I mean, there continues to also be purging of voter files. And I will say that I think for our community, folks are pretty engaged on following up with their ballot. I mean, I've had multiple people already message me about their absentee ballot and why it hasn't come in the mail yet for the presidential primary. And I just remind them, you know, call Orange County Supervisor of Elections, like, check in on your ballot. So we have to also defend our own democracy. And unfortunately, not every person realizes they have that power or knows where to start.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate thing that we have, you know, every American, I feel, deals with a struggle of duality of whether you can trust your government enough to even listen to you, or just, you know, whether they don't know what they're doing or how to go about it.
Right, absolutely.
And I don't know why is there voter suppression? Can you give me your opinion on that?
Yeah, voter suppression exists to maintain the status quo. And I think it's important to remember that it's not always a red versus blue issue. I mean, I think unfortunately today it does tend to be the Republican Party that supports voter suppression versus policies that would allow for there to be more access to the polls. I mean, I would love, for example, automatic rights restoration for folks who've served their time in prison. And I would also like to see automatic voter registration so that as soon as you turn 18, you register to vote. You don't have to worry about it.
Right.
But we get pushback on those ideas in the legislature all the time. And actually, Amendment 4, which majority Floridians supported, which would allow for there to be rights restoration for nonviolent convicted felons who serve their time, my Republican colleagues passed a bill to make that more difficult, to require all fees and fines to be paid, which is not what the voters wanted. So that was done because they realized that if all these new Floridians could vote by 2020, it would be harder for Florida to go to President Trump again. So a lot of it is also designed to delay the transformation already happening in our communities from translating into political power. And we see that across the country. And I remember when in 2011, I was a UCF student, we were registering students to vote, and the Florida legislature passed a bill to make voter registration more difficult, requiring voter registration forms to be turned in within 48 hours, putting into place penalties for folks who didn't register voters correctly. And it led to an exodus of groups doing voter registration because they were worried about facing these type of punishments. And then also the legislature has made voting on campuses more difficult. They have put into place very creative restrictions to continue on this effort of making voting more difficult. And I remember when online voter registration became a real thing. So right now in Florida, you can register vote online.
Oh, good, good.
But no funding towards promoting that. So we're actively trying to share it with our audiences so people know. But even when that bill passed, they delayed its implementation until after the presidential election. So again, wow. You see these efforts to say, okay, we'll give you online voter reg, but we're gonna delay it. We're gonna roll it out a year from now, so folks can't benefit
when it doesn't actually have effect.
Correct. Correct.
That's just stupid. I don't know. I don't have anything else to say, but that's just dumb.
Welcome to the Florida legislature.
I know. And another thing I have regarding the Florida legislature: why isn't healthcare free?
Yeah, it's such a great question. We continue to get pushback to policies, whether it's expanding Medicaid, putting more dollars towards mental health funding, fully funding Department of Health. Now, the Medicare for All debate is really more a congressional debate. And I think there's a lot of reasons why it hasn't moved. I mean, though it has huge support every day, more Democrats than ever are co-sponsors of the legislation. And more Americans support it too, just through polling and surveying. But there's a lot of special interests that don't want that to happen. I mean, insurance companies in particular, they don't want to see Medicare for All. That completely eliminates their entire business model. And in Florida, we never expanded Medicaid, which would have closed the gap for hundreds of thousands of Floridians to finally get access to preventive care. Because right now in Florida, even Medicaid is a very, very narrow program. So you can only qualify for it if you're severely disabled, pregnant. And for those single Floridians that are not pregnant, who are working, but they don't make enough for private insurance, but they make a little too much for Medicaid, they have nowhere to go right now. So we call it the coverage gap. So even here in Florida, we have a lot of work to do, and there continues to be just a kicking a can down the road for my colleagues versus actually addressing the issue.
That's insane. Why is there that? Is it because of capitalism, or what is it?
A lot of it's just political ideology, right? I mean, for Medicaid expansion in particular, it was branded as part of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare.
Yeah.
And our colleagues, this is before my time in the Florida legislature, but our colleagues were very, very much against doing anything that made the president look good. And it wasn't even just healthcare. We even we sent back millions of dollars for a high-speed railway between Orlando and Tampa that even a Republican Congressman, John Micah, wanted. But the state of Florida said no thanks and turned it around because it would have gave President Obama credit for something. So this state has been very keen on not giving in particular President Obama, but I'm sure it was the case before Obama too, but in particular, not letting President Obama have successes in Florida. And that was a pretty constant theme. And I think some of that, the personal vendetta, that political vendetta is still in place today.
Yeah, you could see it everywhere. I certainly see it more starkly nowadays. What are your plans to punish bullying, especially to lower the teen suicide rate?
Oh, gosh. So we need to do a lot more at every level of education to just address bullying and to teach faculty and students what bullying is and why you shouldn't participate in it and why you should also say something when you see it. Yeah. So we have some really great examples of anti-bullying policies in schools, but at the end of the day, you need resources to fund the staff to facilitate the curriculum and to make sure students are participating in it. We also know that LGBTQ plus youth in particular are one of the biggest victims of this. And
especially cyberbullying.
Correct. And the suicide rates among our LGBTQ youth, trans youth in particular, are very high. And our First Lady, Casey DeSantis, has been really championing a lot of this anti-bullying, mental health type of policy work, or, you know, at least kind of lifting up the issue.
Well, good. I'm behind her.
But she has not addressed LGBTQ youth at all. And I have actually, you know, reached out to her staff more than once about it, because if you're going to champion mental health and suicide rates, then you have to talk about LGBTQ
exactly.
youth. There's no way out of it. And so it's very frustrating to see our leaders kind of ignore the issue when it comes to that lens.
What is that? Is it because of an old viewpoint they grew up with?
Right. Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I really think it is. I think it's like this denial that LGBTQ plus people are real. I mean, we till this day, we see conversion bans be denied, right? And conversion therapy bans would basically say conversion therapy is not real. And for those who don't know, conversion therapy is it's kind of actually bad to even call it therapy. It's more like child abuse, but it insinuates that a young person who expresses their identity as being LGBTQ is just going through a phase and can pray the gay away, or can go through this like therapy process to, you know, completely remove their identity for themselves. And it's traumatic and it scars young people. And we've tried to support bans of conversion therapy across the state and country. And these are the same folks who don't want that, who want to see conversion therapy continue.
That's stupid. That sounds like a human rights violation.
100%. Well, right now we're very deep in this battle around Florida's voucher school system, because this is a system that literally public dollars goes towards allowing students to go to private schools. And many of these private schools have either no policy on discrimination for LGBT kids, or worse, they actually have policies that perpetuate intolerance towards LGBTQ youth and families by saying if you are gay, that is merits for expulsion. If your parents are gay, you can't even enroll in our school. And those are schools right here in Florida, and they now have the opportunity to benefit from public dollars. And so we've been on this fight too to say that's not okay.
Yeah, that isn't okay at all. Would you say that public schools have failed the United States?
I would not say that traditional public schools have failed the United States. I will say that as a country, we need to do better when it comes to bullying policies in all of our schools, whether it's traditional public schools, charter schools, or private schools. And even if folks are teaching at their kids at home, they should be curriculum around ensuring that students can detect bullying and say something if they say something. And so I'm actually really proud of some of our traditional public schools for having GSAs, you know, Gay Straight Alliances. And
really?
And Maryland's passing a bill to integrate historical education on the LGBTQ movement alongside some other movements of civil rights for marginalized communities, to integrate that into their curriculum, to teach those histories to kids. And I think that's such an incredible step in the right direction to make sure that we're not omitting those historical moments in our country, that we understand our unfortunately our long history of oppressing rights, but also the fight of those that got us where we are today, and previewing the work we still have to do.
Exactly. You know, It sounds like we got a long way to go still.
We do.
We do?
Yeah, we do. Especially since it's like Florida, but it's worth it. It's yeah. definitely worth it.
Is it harder for you to be a politician as a woman than it is for a man?
I mean, there's definitely a lot of double standards that exist. That's yeah. for sure. Yeah. And you know, Tallahassee definitely continues to be a space dominated by men, without a doubt. But it's changing. You know, right now, 30% of the Florida legislature is women. So we have a long way to go. We're not yeah. even close to half. And majority are not people of color, right? And we only have 3 openly LGBTQ members in the Florida legislature out of 160 people. So we have a lot of work to do in just diversifying those that serve us in the state. And again, that ties back to just people voting and engaging in the process and running for office themselves. But there's challenges. I mean, double standards are very real. You know, there's a lot of people who make assumptions about me that they would never do if I was a man. So I'm constantly having to work twice as hard, if not more, to demonstrate my worthiness to my colleagues. But I'm hopeful that, you know, our efforts to demonstrate the impact and effectiveness of women in politics makes it easier for future generations to get involved in this work as well.
I agree with that 100%. Are you afraid to become known as a career politician?
No, not really. Not really. I mean, I have no idea what's next for me anyways. And I think as long as you don't forget where you come from and stay connected to your community, that even if folks like try to label you as that, it won't really stick. We face a lot of attacks. I mean, we just had this week a push-pull in our district. I call voters asking basically lies about me, saying that I support 9-month abortions, that I want to take away scholarships from low-income marginalized children, that I support a personal agenda over the agenda of our district. I mean, literally, attacks will come all the time, and you just have to really define yourself and stay connected to your district. And I only know that those phone calls happened because my phone was ringing by text messages, emails, constituents calling me, telling me what's happening because they were so shocked. And, you know, hearing stories of constituents yelling at the telephone operator about how ridiculous these questions were and how they weren't true. And that's because we knock on doors. We talk to our voters. We engage with folks on social media. We do town halls. Like, we're everywhere. We're in the neighborhoods.
Yeah. That seems like a childish tactic for them to pull on.
Totally. But politics is like, it really is childish sometimes. And the worst comes out in politics. And it's actually the reason why a lot of women don't participate, because the idea of facing those attacks or a family facing those attacks is really, really difficult and not something.
Has your family faced any trouble? Sorry to interrupt you.
No, you're good. There's been, you know, a lot of racial comments. It's about being Iranian American in general.
I'm terribly sorry that you went through that.
I appreciate that. I mean, again, I do hope that like us paving the way makes it easier for others to follow, and they won't have to go through the same type of rhetoric. But yeah, a lot of assumptions made about, you know, just my cultural identity. My sister's always super like anxious and stressed whenever I get attacked because it feels, you know, it's personal for her. I'm her sister. But you have to have a lot of resilience in this work too. And you just have to ground yourself in who you are inspire others to stand with you. And again, I feel like this entire district is my family because folks just really show up for us. And when we get attacked, they respond passionately. They put yard signs out. They knock on doors with us. They post on Facebook about it. I mean, it's pretty cool to have that type of tight-knit community where folks really just show up for you.
Yeah, we all consider you family here. Like, I live around here in the Milk District, and I talk to people, and I talk to them about you sometimes. And like, yeah, I talked to their head on a show, and she's a wonderful person. And everybody knows who you are, and they're all behind you. And they're all our age, too.
Well, like, I got their back too, right? It has to go both ways. So
it does. But anybody messes with you, you know this whole district's ready. At the ready.
I love it. Thanks for saying that.
You're welcome. It's honest, and you know, you mean a lot to us in the community. You know, we see the changes that you bring, and you inspire my friends of mine. You know, they pay attention to you. It is.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. What is your main goal you are trying to accomplish for 2020?
2020. All right. Well, we're in the middle of legislative session. So we want to make sure that the state budget is one that's equitable, that gives all state employees a raise and gets our teachers a raise, not just first entry-level teachers, but all of our teachers and support staff. We also want to see an increase in arts and culture funding. We want to see an increase in affordable housing dollars, mental health dollars. We want to make sure that our National Guard here in Florida is well funded because they've been underfunded for years. And of course, we're also pushing for an equitable tax structure. So we hold some of these corporations accountable who keep really owning the legislative agenda and are getting tax breaks. They don't deserve it or need it.
Give me your opinion on why that's happening?
Yeah, it's super frustrating. I mean, at the end of the day, it's back to the status quo point. I mean,
yeah, the whole rich stay rich.
Absolutely. And major corporations make huge political contributions and they don't give to me, but they give to a lot of my colleagues. And so they set the agenda. Right now, a collection of car rental companies are asking for a $2 billion tax break.
What?
Meanwhile, they want to tax their competitors, like the new peer-to-peer car sharing platforms. They want those new, you know, entrepreneurial platform apps to have a tax. So it's so ironic that they want a tax break and then they want to see a tax on their competitors. So that happens all the time in Tallahassee. And we're consistently trying to lift up those situations to, again, make taxes fun for everyday people and help other people understand the tax structure in Florida, because it really is regressive. And part of our other goals, too, is you know, it's really hard to pass bills in the Florida legislature as any Democrat. But we do hope to at least inspire public support of these issues so that it becomes more palpable in Tallahassee to push forward on issues like clean energy, like gun safety legislation, like issues around holding polluters accountable, around ensuring access to healthcare. So a part of me knows all too well that it takes time to pass good policy in Tallahassee, and change doesn't happen overnight. But every time we file a bill and we file it again, it gets more and more likely to actually becoming law. So we're gonna keep pushing on some of the issues that we were elected to uphold, but also doing our best to make sure the state budget is one that's equitable and includes the raises that I talked about and really ensures that some of the most important programs are well funded in our state.
You're a hard worker. You're a really hard worker. That made me tired just hearing it.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Yeah.
So true.
We're at the end of the hour of the show. Is there any last things you want to say, Anna?
Just so much gratitude to you and to folks who are listening. And, you know, if you want to get more involved and keep in touch with us, like, please do. We're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Anna for Florida, all spelled out with two N's. So you can join us, you know, on these digital platforms, Anna for Florida. And then you can always email me. My state house email is anna.escamani@myfloridahouse.gov. Keep in touch with us. And if you're a constituent and have issues, never be shy to reach out. If we can help you, we can definitely find out who will be able to serve you, whatever the situation you might be in.
Well, thank you, Anna. And this has been another episode of The Experience with Chris Fio. And I look forward to talking to you again soon. By then, who know where I go? But right now I know there's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. Just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. Just you and me. There's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place in the world that I'd rather be than right here, just you and me. There's no place that I'd rather be than right here. The Experience with Chris Fio is produced by Boris Douglas Garvey and Kyle Eagle. It is a joint production of Borma, Vonti, and PFT Media. The theme song is You and Me by NWR Superstar. A PFT Media production.